Good afternoon. It's 5:44 and you're listening to All Things Considered on WVTF Radio IQ. I'm Beverly Amsler, joined by journalist Beth Macy, whose final story for the Roanoke Times will be published Sunday. It brings us up to date on a controversial story she wrote 21 years ago. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks, Beverly.
1993. A lot of things were different then, such as attitudes about that of unwed mothers. And the title of the story then was Pregnant and Proud, and it featured Shannon and Tasha, who were African-American, unwed, pregnant teenagers. What was the backlash like after the story ran?
Wow. Well, it was really a surprising backlash to me, who had been immersed in the reporting of the subject for about a month or two at that point. We got so many phone calls that the editor had to call in extra editorial assistants to answer the phone. The story went viral really before that term existed.
You know, people were angry.
People were really angry. They were mad at me and said that I had done everything from exploit them, intentionally being racist because they were African American, to sort of the other side, which is I had glamorized teen pregnancy and made it something that was poignant and good. And it felt very personal to me at the time because it just continued. It continued. It continued. Every day for 2 months, we ran angry letters to the editor until finally somebody wrote in and said, "You would think that Beth Macy personally impregnated these girls. To fix a problem, you have to see it first." And so that was the one I remembered, you know, word for word, because it was like, oh, finally somebody gets it, that they're a little bit trying to kill the messenger here.
But being a teen and being pregnant back in 1993, that was almost like a badge of honor.
It was in some communities. I don't think it was everywhere. You have to remember that at the time, Roanoke had the very highest teen pregnancy rate in the state. And so my editor had come to me after the latest data came out and said, you know, why Roanoke? Why not Richmond? Why not Norfolk? And so I just kind of cast my net wide. And I had already done one story kind of quoting all the experts that had run a week, maybe a week before this story ran. And this story was specifically examining the attitudes and the psychology of teen pregnancy among this group that was turning up in the schools. I mean, there were a lot of them that by and large, at the time they went to the school for pregnant teens. These two girls were sort of held out to me as role models because they had stayed in the regular school instead of going to the school for pregnant teens. And their counselors had said, you know, these girls are really doing even better than they were before they were pregnant. They were starting to take their studies more seriously. And what they told me was, you know, that they were really proud of them.
But then they dropped out of school after
the story
ran.
I'm not sure exactly when. There was a lot going on in their lives that I didn't know about. And so that brings us to the story that's running in the extra section on Sunday. I found out what happened to them, and I found out a lot more about what was going on in their lives at the time. Well, it's really a profile of one of them. And just kind of pointed out to me how much I had just scratched the surface with that first piece.
Back in 1993, was there any discussion in the newsroom as to how this story might be perceived by readers?
You know, this one kind of caught us by surprise, and we looked back on it because, I mean, you just couldn't notice how mad the community was with us. One prevention worker who had helped me with several of articles that I had written at the time wrote in to say, you know, shame on me, basically. The girls had no way to know they were putting themselves out there that way and, you know, jeopardizing their reputations, but that the Roanoke Times could not have not known. And that felt really, you know, personal to me.
Well, you were also pregnant at this time, but married. How did this change you personally and in your career as a reporter?
Yeah, I was pregnant at the time. I was in the middle of my first pregnancy. It happened to be high risk. I had gestational diabetes. You know, I was a 29-year-old reporter. I had been doing hard stories for just a couple of years. It changed me a lot. There's no way not to have been affected by the fact that they dropped out of school and to worry all these years that what I had written or how the story had been packaged or just the whole reaction that I could not have predicted would impact these young lives.
So you second-guessed yourself?
Oh, sure, sure. I second-guess myself with almost every story. And I find the older and maybe smarter that I get, the more I do that, the more I tend to bolt upright in the middle of the night going, oh, my God, was I fair? Did I get both sides in the story? Did I spell that person's name right?
Did it affect you as your career progressed that maybe people went, uh-huh, that's Beth Macy. Yep, I'm not going to talk to her because of that story she ran. Did
oh, that
it follow you?
That happened for a couple of years. I was out with a photo intern one summer doing a story on a crack house that had been converted to a church on Roar Avenue. And it was a great story, and the photographer had found it. And I was trying to get the neighbors on that block to speak to me, and they found out who I was and that I was the reporter that had done that story, and they weren't going to talk to me at first. And I had to do what every good reporter does. I had to sort of circle around them and get somebody to vouch for me that I wasn't the evil enemy here. And it turned out an editor in our newsroom who was a community leader named Joanne Poindexter actually went to the house and spoke to the person and said, you know, she's a good reporter. She cares about these people. And then they spoke to me.
On the flip side, this story back in 1993 garnered awards.
Sure. It launched the creation of a citywide teen pregnancy task force. It was, I guess, career-wise, good for me. To me personally, I think the best part was that it made me think a lot deeper about every story that I did that was related to socioeconomics and race and poverty. And it made me just be more conscious of the fact that words matter, the exact words matter, the packaging matters, the photos matter, the headlines matter, and how you treat people matters. Not only that, but you can't predict. And I tell people this all the time. If I'm starting out to write a story where I'm going to spend a month or two with somebody, and it's I know it's going to be controversial. These are kind of the stories I'm just generally attracted to. I say, I can't predict how the public is going to react to your story. I can only promise that I'll do my very best, and I will try to convey what the truth of this story is in a really fair and accurate way. But I can't predict. Somebody might hate it, and, you know, you might get nasty emails or something. I can't predict that.
Why revisit this story, then, as your final story for the Roanoke Times?
Well, it just happened that way, which was I had done a story in 2010 on a man I had met while covering the election, Barack Obama's first election. He was a convicted felon who had just got his voting rights restored. And I met him at the polling place. And he just was one of these great community characters. And he had this amazing story. His name was Anthony West. He'd been a convicted drug dealer. And he had gone to school while he was in prison. And he had come out and he had really set himself up on the right path. And he was one of these amazing characters that just knows everyone in town, black and white, rich and poor. And during the course of shadowing him for this story that I was writing about his work trying to get other convicted felons to find work through this program called Virginia Cares, it just dawned on me, this guy knows everyone. Hey, Anthony, do you know Shannon and Tasha? And he did. He knew them. He knew their families. And that was my entree. And we had this big discussion about the story. And, you know, it just led to some really great insights for me personally.
Well, give us a sneak peek as to the story that's going to run on Sunday. How are the girls, of course, now they're women, doing now?
One is in prison and about to be released. Her family did not wish for her to participate in the story, nor did they wish to comment, although I spoke with one relative on several occasions about it. The other was Shannon Huff. And when Anthony said, told me about Shannon, he was really proud of her. He said she had been through some tough times, but she had really gotten her life together. At the time, she was an assistant manager at a fast food restaurant, and their kids were on the same basketball team. And Shannon was kind of like the team mom, would bring food from the restaurant to picnics and whatnot. And so I contacted her, and she was excited to talk to me, but her life got complicated. She didn't say why, but she backed out on the story. About a year later, I thought, well, I'm going to get back in touch with Shannon. Every time I'd drive through that particular restaurant when I'd be up near Fleming, I would drive through and see if she was working. I always asked for her and would just say hi and kind of remember me. She got back in touch with me when her life settled down some. And she's runs a store now in near Vinton. And She has four children, and as she says, I'm not Michelle in the White House, but I'm doing a lot better than anybody would have predicted I'm doing. She says, by all rights, I should be dead now. But having these children and wishing the best for them, and her fear of them ending up in foster care really set her on the right path.
Can you read us a little bit of the story?
Sure. Shannon was mostly self-sufficient, though she received food stamps and school lunch assistance. Her children were thriving, she told me in a 2011 phone interview. Her oldest, Sharante, then a high school senior, was struggling with grades but was on track to graduate on time. She was studying cosmetology at school, just as Tasha had once planned to do. I've made some bad choices, Shannon said on the telephone, including several years of drug dealing in the 90s. A felony conviction in 1997 for possession of cocaine resulted in a three-month incarceration. A family friend had kept her children, Sharante was then four, and her son, Kershawn, 9 months, and the incarceration scared her straight, she said. Not only had she missed Kershawn's first steps, but the memory of her children visiting her in jail became a haunting reminder. Her friend had been late bringing them to visiting hours, and Shannon could just barely see her children waving to her from the lawn. She stood atop a cafeteria picnic table in the jail and waved back through the window. She told herself, I am better than this.
What do you want readers to take away from this story?
For me personally, what I took away from the story was just persistence, that when I'm writing a story that's tough and I know it's going to be controversial, my allegiance is really to the truth, to being fair and to being true. And I learned through the backlash of this story that I was just going to dig more deeply on every story, and I was going to try to be more humane and more true about the complexities of poverty, race, and family life. And I think this story taught me a lot. I was buoyed by Shannon's turnaround. I think she's pretty impressive. It's not everyone who could come from a life of drug dealing. She was basically abandoned by her family. At the age of 16, she had a three-month-old with her. This was, you know, months after my story ran. And she kept her family going through it all. I interviewed one of the police, a police sergeant in the neighborhood who befriended her. He would go to her house on domestic violence calls and drug-related investigations. And they became friends. And you got to admire just the spark of somebody who's willing to try to make a change for her children.
On a brighter note, your new book, Factory Man, coming out next month. What's it all about?
The main character is John Bassett III, who runs Vaughn Bassett Furniture in Galax, Virginia. And it's the tale of how he took on China and the Court of International Trade to keep his factory going. And, you know, by extension, to sort of save the town. I say he helped save the town. That's in the subtitle of the book. So it's a great character study. It's a business book. It's being cast as, you know, sort of the book you would give your mother who grew up in a factory town that didn't understand why everything had changed so much and all the factories were closed.
What does your future hold now? More books?
Yeah, I just signed a contract to write my second book. It'll be published by the same publisher, Little Brown & Company, and it probably won't come out until 2016. And it's got some similar themes to the things we've talked about today. It's about race, greed, and entertainment in the Jim Crow South. So I've got a lot of challenges ahead of me, a deep dive of research to do, and I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Best for the future, Beth.
Thanks so much, Beverly. Appreciate it.
That's journalist and former Roanoke Times reporter, Beth Macy.